Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, General Overseer of Beyond, which specialises in creating full cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, as well as providing background and other production resources. You can support our work and get a say in what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Anyway, today I'm delighted to be joined by Tony Tambasco, Artistic Director of Bad Quarto Productions, to discuss their production of The Life and Death of Jack Straw from 2016. And I have to start with a massive apology, an ongoing mega apology, in fact. This is the second of four lost discussing episodes, recordings made in some cases years ago, and never released for a number of reasons, not just the pandemic, but other technical reasons delayed and delayed and delayed them all. This was recorded in January 2019, so it's nearly 3.5 years old, which means it's pre-pandemic and mid-Trump. So we discuss rehearsing this wild idea of rehearsing via Skype, which seemed so futuristic and is now really very commonplace, except we use Zoom instead because it's better. And we've since moved entirely online ourselves, actually, since then. So it's a very different world. Also, you can hear my thinking aloud about a play that we hadn't actually recorded at that point. So there is now a full cast audio adaptation of Jack Straw, which you can listen to now, and many spoilers episode on it. But at the point of recording this, I was still working my way through the text and trying to decide what to do with it. So in many ways, a many thanks to Tony for helping me to find a route into the play, even if we didn't always completely agree on what to do with it. The political world gets a long mention too. I considered cutting a lot of this out, but I've left a lot of it in because I think the context is quite important. Their production of Jack Straw was performed either side of the 2016 US elections, and the recording was made in 2019 when Trump was still in power and Brexit was still an active negotiation. Tony is not far out in some of his predictions about where the political world was going as well, which is slightly depressing. I can only apologise again for the late appearance of this episode. It was going to go out with the full cast audio adaptation, which is online now, but it was then delayed to go out with our live stage version, which was cancelled by COVID. And then COVID happened, and then there were some technical problems with trying to get the recordings to mesh. And now, at last, sees the light of day of this discussing episode. So, my guest from the past, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
My name is Tony Tambasco, and I am a director. I specialize in plays by his contemporaries. Somehow, in grad school, I started specializing in these quirky plays that nobody really likes and or knows about. I think I most directly can trace that to a class I took with Rosalind Knutson, where one of the first plays we read was the best romantic comedy with a necromancer that you've never heard of. It's called The Merry Devil of Edmonton. She kind of introduced this as we're going to read a lot of bad plays in this class, and the general consensus in the class, I think, like, this is a really bad play. And I'm like, what are you talking about? This play is hilarious. So that became my my MLit thesis project, and that kind of kicked off Bad Quarto Productions, where we explore these dingy corners of text and staging conditions. And
I think we could probably talk about many, many plays, but I asked you to talk about Jack Straw because I have the joy of recording that, or starting recording that, in a few weeks' time. Tell me how you came to know Jack Straw and came to do a production.
Well, that was another play that I encountered in grad school. It was for a different class where, you know, generally speaking, again, like there's this agreement like, oh, this isn't a very good play. And I was like, well, I kind of like it, actually. I wound up saying that a lot, especially when you look at it in the context of Richard II. And that's, I think, one of its real charms is it helps contextualize that play. You know, how did we get from this boy who is so brave and loves his people so much that as a child he's going to go out and meet these rebels and through the sheer force of his personality talk them down to a man who does not have advisors, you know, and doesn't have counselors to give him guidance and is trying to do it all by himself. And I think this play kind of tells that story. Because he learned that he was vulnerable. He learned that being the king wouldn't necessarily protect him the way he believed it would in his childish fantasies. And he learned that he would have advisors who were looking out for their own best interests more than his own. So that's where he kind of gets this whole god complex king from. And that's what leads him to be a terrible king later on.
Yes, because it is that starting point. We have Thomas of Woodstock in between, and then we have Richard II by that playwright that I'm only allowed to mention so many times per episode.
Well, and there again, like that was another interesting thing to me. I can't remember which book it was, but some book I read along the way that was talking about Richard's the Second's use of propaganda and imagery. And how he was really the first English king who was trying to, like, deliberately fashion an image of himself in the public consciousness in the modern sense of the word, you know, have a PR department. And I think that kind of it stems from, of course, the time he was at and those new painting modes that were accessible to him, and new technologies that were accessible to him. But it also, I think, comes from this story. Partly the timing was right, because when we were looking at plays for that 2016 season, you know, that was at the beginning, of course, of this ultra nationalist candidacy that we were seeing really around the world. As that kind of kicked off and built up steam, I think we made the final decision about our season in late January of 2016. It was clear that for whatever reason, certain politicians that should have been going away were not, and an establishment that should have been able to deal with them were not. It seemed like a cool idea to have this play perform both before and after that election in this country. And the second weekend of performances was very different from the first.
Let's talk about the play script that we have. It's not very long.
No.
As plays goes, for us, it's really useful as a sort of transition text from we've been mostly doing sort of Tudor interludes, which are by their nature are very short. So it's an increase in cast size and sort of scale of what's happening, but it's not in terms of length excessively long. It's about 8,500 words, depending on what you do with the pardon. And it's telling the story of the Peasants' Revolt, which is dear to my locality. At least one local person got his head chopped off round our way. Do we know, or did you look into why we think it's so short, or what is this text that has come to us?
I always look into that. Part of the mission of Bad Quarto Productions is to create context for these plays, in part to encourage other people to do them. But I think the honest answer with so much of work from this period is I don't know. I've heard various theories put forth about, you know, maybe it was for a Lord Mayor's pageant. There's that popular theory that plays were cut for tours, which I think is completely wrong.
Yep. With you on that one.
there are some theories that they were cut for winter performances and then they got printed. I think it's so hard to tell just because unlike a lot of plays, it's not printed with an acting company on it. We know it was registered in 1593 and it was printed in 1594. So there were a couple different options for professional playing companies. I mean, it might never have been performed. It might have been printed as a literary object. And that's one of the things that really struck me about this play. If you look at the quartos of it, that unlike some plays that were printed from professional playing company plays. There was a lot of care taken in this one.
Yeah, yeah.
It is in the quarto, broken down into four acts, and the King's Speech is set aside in its own text with its own devices on it in such a way that I really thought that was the speech. Like, just looking at the care they took with it. And, you know, I sat down and I looked through the archives, like, looking for confirmation of that. And when I couldn't find it, I was a little bit horrified. Mm. I'm like, wow, I got suckered. Go go early modern printers. I think it works pretty well as a stage play. And you know, of course, Bad Quarto, one of the reasons why we stage them is to say, well, if you're convinced it doesn't work as a stage play, think again. I mean, there's lots of fights. There's some bits of clowning. Mm. I think there's some bits of clowning that make sense as visual jokes.
Oh, yes.
A bit with Knobs cutting off the body of the goose.
The goose is one of one of my notes to discuss is the goose. I absolutely would concur. It's a theatrical text. You know, it's designed for performance. It makes no sense as a specifically literary thing, but it does appear to be incomplete in some way. You get the impression that some elements of it seem like you every so often you look around a corner and go, "Have I missed something?" Especially some of the detailing with the movement of Richard's forces against the rebels and the back and forth that happens there. But why it's been cut is, of course, a different question. It doesn't automatically mean it's worse, or you know, it's just an interesting question of what survives and why it survives, of which I don't have an answer.
And I saw that a little bit with the first one we did with Mary Devil of Edmonton. Like, you know, there's some confusion in the text that we receive about, you know, how did they get from here to there? And you know, they allude to a piece of action, like the swapping of the sign, that one has to only wonder, why isn't it in the printed text? But at the same time, like, that play was reprinted 6 times. Mm. So, like, as a print object, it sold well enough to warrant these reprintings. So, you know, I have to believe that they're looking at the play and saying, oh, this is worth spending money on, because people did. As you say, like, I think there might be some leeway on, because it's history that presumably people would have known. And I think that's just in the back of my mind right now. We at the other theater I work at, the Gateway, we just brought in the one man Star Wars trilogy last night. And if you were unfamiliar with the Star Wars trilogy, you would have no idea what's going on. If you know the Star Wars trilogy, then it's kind of a fun send up of some of the goofier things about it. And there is, of course, that idea that these plays are made as memorial objects, first and foremost, for people who had seen the production. But I think also, you know, you can't just hop in the train and go into London for a night on the theater, you know. So these plays might also be for people outside of London who want that taste of that high culture. That sometimes they can't get, even on tour, where you see that, you know, like, the mayor of Cambridge, like, gave the players money to just go away.
Oh, yes, yes. So, I always like that. It's just, yeah, no, it's just easier, just leave.
Not to offend the Lord Chamberlain or anything, here's some money, just go away. But, I mean, that was another way, so... I think that opens us up to questions about why are playbooks printed? What use did they have? Which kind of taps into this whole thing about how were things read? And there we get into, you know, we sit and we read books, and we're mostly reading in our heads, and we're hearing it in our mind's ear. And very probably reading in the 1590s, early 1600s was an out loud affair. All that is to say, it's a very convoluted way of saying I don't know, and there's a lot of reasons why I don't know, and I think we'll honestly never really know. But 90 minutes is about the right length for any performance of anything in New York City these days. I think the 90-minute no intermission show has its own genre now, and I think a lot of these plays that appear in the 1590s come in at about that.
Okay, so you produced Jack Straw. Tell me about the process, how the production, you put the production together. What was your process?
Well, for all Bad Quarter production shows, we're kind of based on the idea of an early modern rehearsal process that we get from Tiffany Stern in Shakespeare in Parts. It's different. There's this idea in the period that the entire company would have rehearsed probably once as a group. They would have met on the day that they rehearsed, were going to open the play, and they would have got together and they would have put all the pieces together, and then they would have opened for the first time that afternoon. And we do something similar. We meet to stage the show on the day that we open. That's often the first time everybody meets as a group. We set up, stage our way through it. And that evening, because, you know, we're not performing at 2 p.m. and nobody wants to get to Midtown Manhattan by 6 a.m. But that's where we have our opening. Backwards from there, we also there's the idea that there was individual instruction in that period, which was probably Burbage just telling the junior members of the company how to perform, like, you know, say it like this, stand here, move your arm like this, that sort of thing. And we do a version of that where it's what we think of as, you know, modern directing, actor coaching. You know, I do some text work, and a lot of it actually happens to be through Skype.
Yes.
Because quite frankly, it saves us money and it saves us time, and it's a lot easier to convince people to do this if they know, well, I don't have to take the train into Manhattan every evening, and I can do this basically wherever I'm at. And that too, I'm fudging it when I say it's a modern, early modern staging convention, but really I think these companies were very thrifty, and they did things that made sense economically. And that's, I think, not to say that they put art completely on the back burner. But you know, they could not afford to spend hours a day rehearsing a play that they didn't need to rehearse.
Well, I mean, there's always a fundamental difference between whatever a modern company, or most modern companies, can do, which is, of course, they're only ever working towards that next production. They're not part of a repertoire performing a number of plays.
So
the actors would, within the unit, have the opportunity to discuss and meet. And as many of these plays are revivals, a lot of the time it's a matter of just simply re-remembering something you did a couple of weeks ago, which is a very different actorly skill, which is because I'm a storyteller, it's reviving a text, 45 minutes of words that I haven't performed in a year. You can do it in a day. It's astoundingly quick if you've decided not to forget something. So
I didn't say it was perfect.
No. But it is interesting that, you know, in a sense, we're doing more work.
Yeah.
To recreate something, and it goes to show that in that sense, if we can do it under these conditions, in a sense, we've got more limitations than they would have done.
I think,
so if it's possible, then it must be possible.
You know, and that's something that I think was always in the back of my mind, and hopes and dreams to kind of form like this stable company that could perform a repertory of plays. Did not quite work out that way.
Actors like to move on. It's one of those problems.
Well, and that was, at least in America, the dream of the regional theater movement, is that you would be able to have these repertory companies. And they found out pretty quickly in that process that, you know, it's like, I'll move to Texas for a year and stay here, but after that, I want to get back to doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the culture of theater in this country, is that you know, you've got to be working on a lot of things. And if you're not working on a lot of things, then you're not doing enough. There's something I think tragic about that. And I, you know, that was a moment that I had when my wife and I, and she co-runs this company with me, were like, we are killing ourselves and to produce this season of plays as kind of a part-time thing. And we are falling short of goals for creating this textual context around the plays. Like initially, you know, I wanted to produce these plays as a way of producing scripts and material. So kind of like an open access art in Shakespeare, for lack of a better description. That would describe the text and the performance. And we haven't done that. And producing more plays more quickly means that we could never do that. And so we kind of decided to take a step back and evaluate what we were doing and what we wanted to do and how we wanted to move forward. But it's just a fact. Like, you know, we encourage everyone to be busy and to produce a lot of stuff and to develop their CVs very quickly. You know, and I've been guilty of that too. And when I look back on it, like, I think does the work suffer for it? Yes. But it's the culture, and it's what you have to contend with. And I think we all have that dream of, you know, as we tick off these shows, like, oh yeah, I'm gonna come back and work on that again someday. At the same time, do I also feel that plays by, you know, the lesser done works, like, say, The Life and Death of Jack Straw, need to be done? And do they need to be done in this way? I think, yeah, because partly that means we don't have the time to overthink it. And we kind of get to the meat about what is the story about very quickly. And we don't get hung up on some of the details. And we also stage it using those early modern staging conditions. So we have the universal lighting, we have the thrust space, and we try to recreate that feeling of, you know, these are the actors that rolled up into town this morning, and they'd set up shop in the local guild hall or Lord's Hall, and we're going to have a play this afternoon. Is it perfect every time? No, but
then so the idea of perfection is quite an odd concept, really. It's a very modern concept. So relatively condensed rehearsal period then. Once you got into the text, how did everyone find it?
I think some people found it more accessible than others, and that's always the way. You know, there are some people who, when they look at a project like this and they say, oh yeah, this is really exciting, like, I want to dig into this. And they do it because they want this kind of experience of doing that. You know, we're going to meet one-on-one for a few hours a week and for like 4 or 5 weeks. And then we're going to meet in person and put it all together. Some people are looking to get some training and experience. So I think it's kind of a function of who they are when they come into it. And because we do the live acoustic music thing, like, I'm looking for people of all sorts of skills. So, like, I always need some singers in my group. I always need some musicians. So I can't speak for the company as a whole, but I think our regulars in the company at that point, you know, found it to be fairly typical for some of these plays. And as you say, there are certain gaps in the plot that require some explaining and imagination. There is a little bit of filling in from the historical record that we have to do.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, this is what happens. And then you get into that thing that when you've done that, where if the actor knows in their own mind what just happened and what something means, they can make it meaningful.
Yeah, it does help that it has on the whole, very linear plot. You know, we know, you know, it's not like there's a subplot or there's other things going on per se. Who knows? Maybe there was one, but and that accounts for X amount. But I it doesn't feel like that.
No, so, I mean, the closest thing we get are Nobbs and Tom Miller. You have the kind of like a comic subplot going on,
yeah, in the sense that they're sort of around the central action, because in a sense Jack Straw and Wat Tyler don't actually do very much. They're not actually huge parts. When you actually break down who says the most, well, the nobles all talk a lot,
yes,
and then the rebels for the most part speak, you know, to the point, bit of a debate, but then they move on, whereas Nobbs has this sort of inner well, in a dialogue with the audience. You know, you get the impression he's the one who survives.
He's the devil. And that's it. Like, he, Knobs goes into this thing saying, you know, like, I'm going to instigate them to this stuff, and because I'm just a boy, they're not going to hang me. And then, like, Knobs, I think, is the one that does some of the more horrific stuff on stage. Like, he's the one who kills the foreigner.
Oh, I was going to say, does he kill the foreigner? Does the text actually state that? I mean, it's implicated, but does it? Is it a thing that every night it's different?
When we staged it, he definitely killed the foreigner.
Yeah. Well, I say, it was one of my questions. Does because he, you know, it's close. Because for the audience at home,
I think so. And I think where I got that from is because he does instigate this, where you know, he's like, you know, you can't just take that and walk away kind of early on in the play.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, like, he's a kid, and there's a chance for him to go Lord of the Flies on everything and get away with it scot-free, and he's going to take it.
Well, it's because it's set down by our captains that as many of you cannot say bread and cheese in good and perfect English, ye die for it. So he's been handed this opportunity to have power. And this poor Fleming, who literally has three words to say... says something that's brood and keys is how it's written, and it just says exuant both, but it doesn't actually state what happens to them, and it's the question that I think that matters. I mean, I think it's up to the director, as you killed, and I think I would as well. I don't think I haven't decided yet. I've got, you know, the fate of the Fleming is currently in my hands.
I know. I 100% agree. Like, where it is not clear in the text, that is the director's job to make it clear. And you know, I say Knobs is the devil, and maybe you say he's a wayward youth who's gone astray.
I think he's a survivor. Again, I think he's a survivor.
We'll agree to disagree.
Oh yeah, no. I think that's good. I think if we did agree on everything, that would be terrible.
Partly because that, and that might be, like I said, that nativist politics that was happening in real time all around us. But there is the cost. Like, if you're going to talk about these foreigners in front of your kids, you're teaching them that lesson. You're teaching them that these are disposable people. You're teaching them that they're an infestation that needs to be dealt with.
Mm.
You know, I kind of glammed on to this idea that Knobs was going to be that vice character. And he's got the big knife ready, and you know, the way it worked out in our production was fun because James Overton, who played the Fleming, is a big guy. Like, he's, you know, over 6 feet tall, and Madeline Morrell, who played Knobs, is not as large. So we get into this thing where you have somebody smaller who's killing somebody much larger and then dragging them off stage, and she had a little bit of trouble with that, and that was kind of that darkly humorous thing as she's talking about, you know, these foreigners eating all our food and whatnot as she drags them off stage.
Mm.
And that political rhetoric was happening all around us at the end. I mean, it still is now.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because you mentioned height. Tom Miller, the clown, seems there's an awful lot of play in the dialogue about his height. Were you able to make anything of that? Is there, I mean, it's a question of, it's odd. It's one of these quirks that I'm interested in.
Yeah,
it doesn't really apply to me because I'm an audio producer, so ultimately the audience won't get it. But you know, I can do my best.
Honestly, not especially. Like, Alana was not short by any stretch, but I think the tallest person on stage was James Overton, who in addition to the Fleming also played Parson Ball.
Mm.
And I think that was part of the thing I was going at, because that there's, you have that iconic image of John Paul on the horse talking to the crowd, and I wanted to recreate that as best as I could, and you know, it's just a fact that when you have somebody who's like bigger and taller, and they just command that visual presence, and I wanted that. Not for Tom Miller, we went for more of the ridiculous things he does, like how he's trying whether he should hang himself or not, and those bits of his foolish attempts to strangle himself using a like his belt and a staff, and begging the pardon of the queen, and
And
what means he by all this eloquence? And
so, which brings us, I think, neatly to the goose. So that which is another sort of visual element that he's got this goose. It sort of just describe this scene, because again, it's another one of these very short knob interventions, shall we say?
Sure. Tom, very quickly after the rebels decide they're going to replace these evil counselors and seek justice and representation for themselves, turn to spoil and just kind of pillaging and theft. And Tom Miller is one of these. And he comes out with a goose in his hand is talking about how, hey, yeah, I just stole this goose and this is great. We can just take whatever we want. And by the time he's done, Nobbs has snuck up and cut the body off of the goose, leaving him holding the head. And that, of course, is a wonderful metaphor for the show and the pillaging that the rebels are doing as a whole. Like, you know, if we have this society where anyone can take anything, that means they can take it from you too. And the way we staged that was more or less as I described it. You know, we had a prop goose with a detachable neck and body, and Tom Miller is getting really up on himself and describing that, you know, what paradise we are going to make with theft and pillage. And while he's talking and stretching out and just having himself a good time, Nobbs sneaks up with his knife and just cuts the body off and runs away. And then he's left to be like, wait a minute, where's the rest of it?
Yes, because the suggestion is he doesn't even notice that it happens. It's that the goose is, what is the goose flown away without her head?
Yeah.
And it is, again, for me, it's one of these difficult sequences where I'm going, I might not be able to depict that in my version, because it's a visual gag and there's only so much I can do. I might do a separate documentary entirely on the goose, just so that we can discuss this might essentially be the core of what we're doing now, which is just discussing physical comic action that I can't do anything with. So is there a big difference between the rebels and what's going on in the king's camp? Because obviously they're portrayed very differently in certain ways. But are there differences as well as similarities between them? The king's men talk in incredibly long speeches, and it all seems very formal from the page. But
yeah.
Actually, when you get down to it, what's going on?
Well, and there we get into one of the things about the play that I haven't quite been able to figure out, you know, what does this mean? That we know that the king is being seduced by these evil counselors, and that they're kind of taking advantage of running the show while he's a boy. And the play just doesn't treat them that way. And the reason I say that is because I think the play goes to great lengths early on to quickly turn this rebellion from some noble cause into, like, yeah, we're going to steal stuff and burn stuff and it's going to be awesome. And I think over the course of three scenes, you get the rebels turning to pillage, where it begins in a way that I think we can all identify with, like the suggestion that the king's tax collector has sexually assaulted Jack Straw's daughter. Like, what father wouldn't be up in arms over that? And the way we staged it, it was kind of an accidental killing of the tax collector that kind of snowballed from there.
It does suggest that in the text, throws him to the ground and then he just says, oh, help, help, the king's officer is slain. There's no suggestion in the text that, you know, that he's attacked him in an overt way. He's just pushed him to the ground.
Yeah, and the way I guess it's worth mentioning, the way that we staged that is the tax collector had this sword cane and went to beating Jack with it. And when Jack fought back, he drew the sword, and then they had a struggle over the sword. And then Jack got the sword and the tax collector sort of ran on it when trying to get it back. Mm. And then that sword kind of became a symbol of the rebellion. And ultimately, Jack got stabbed by it at the end. But the counselors, like, they have this justification for the tax early on in the play, like in scene two, right before they hear about the rebellion. They're just kind of standing there talking about, like, people are too slow to pay this tax and they need to pay the tax. And there are all these justifications for why it's in the king's best interest to do it. And that's one of those things where if you know the history, like you try to find some ways to build in that this is an entirely self-serving thing. And, you know, they're collecting money on their own behalf. But that is hard to do. And that's something that I think the cast struggled with a little bit, because unless you're going to have them, you know, be those mustache twirling bad guys, I think every evil person on any stage, if done well, they have their motivations and they believe they're the good guy. You know, they believe they're doing the right thing. And I think it's important that those counselors believe in their hearts that these peasants are just that, to borrow a phrase, that basket of deplorables, and they're an untapped source of wealth, and they have so much more than they're willing to give to the king, and they need to find a way to transfer that wealth to the estate of the king, who needs it, i.e. their own pockets, because here they are trusted with protecting the realm, and they don't have the money they need to do it.
There is a real class distinction going on here. There is a disconnect between what the nobles are seeing. They're seeing a bunch of rebels and not actually seeing that there are grievances here that might be met.
Right, and that's just it. Like they don't see their own evil. Just like I think on the other hand, the peasants don't see their own evil. Like, gotta kill the foreigners. They're eating our food. Gotta do something about that. I think the difference is the play makes it explicit that what the peasant rebels are doing is like destructive and evil. And we get a lot of that, oh, these poor peasants, they don't know what they're doing is wrong. They don't have this capacity to understand that this is a terrible thing they're doing. And I think that's something that you get especially on Richard's behalf. He's like, these are my people and I love them and I don't want to hurt them. And whatever you do, make sure that you're not going to kill them unless absolutely necessary.
There is an isolation of the king from the acts done in his name. The whole business with the sword at the end, which is a fiddly bit of business, which I think I've figured out. In terms of who's got the sword, he won't give up the sword on behalf of the king, even though the king said give up the sword, and it's this sort of weird little bit of action, which I think probably works better than it reads.
When we staged it, the kind of the way around that was by having John Newton and these other knights. They had a broadsword, like your heavy military weapon, and they also had their rapier as a sidearm. And so when Jack Straw is like, give me that sword, and the king is like, it's not a big deal, so he just kind of takes the rapier right out of Newton's scabbard and gives it to Jack, and then Jack has the rapier, is like, no, I want, and then John draws the broadsword on him, because now all of a sudden he's armed with an actual sword in front of him that he's worried about. So he draws the broadsword, and then Jack is like, no, I want that one. And John Newton is like, uh-uh. And at that point, Richard is like, oh, no, I've just done a terrible thing. Like,
and it's an interesting, the way the whole situation is managed, you know, you get that initial parley where, well, you get the turnout of the forces that doesn't happen from Richard, with the withdrawal and the which leads to the looting. Then you have the parley whereby the sort of extended forces of Hob Carter, the Essex contingent, agree to leave, thereby weakening the rebels' position. And it's I don't think the play gives a sense of inevitability that this will turn around, because of course Richard in real life had no particular intention of ever honouring any of these promises. Yeah. It's this thing of what is this play doing with history as opposed to what history was doing, which is the other thing, which is sort of odd considering how badly Richard turns out in so many other plays, is this sort of interesting isolation. Does the play ever intimate his age? Because obviously history, we know in history, is about, what, 14?
I think it does. And I think that comes early on when his mother's there. I would have to go back and look at the text specifically, but I definitely walked away with this feeling that he was just kind of a boy. Contextually, I mean, just the fact that, you know, his mother is there and is worrying about him and seems to have so much of a say, and that his advisors are the ones running things. I think it suggests that he's not really running the show.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, we have the Queen Mother, the woman of the play, which makes casting a challenge in terms of trying to balance out genders a bit. So you changed change a lot of the genders in your production?
Genders of the characters, no.
But the actors. But
I'm a believer in cross-gendered casting. Yeah. I used to call it that. I'm trying to call it more inclusive casting now because I want our plays to reflect what our community looks like. Mm. And I feel that that is more important than any notion of historical accuracy to the characters, because as we just discussed, the play itself is not what we would call historically accurate.
No.
If we were historians. So we cast inclusively, and that means that generally speaking, you know, I want about half of these roles played by women and half played by men. Hmm. And that means, you know, as much racial diversity as I can get into these shows. And generally I leave the characters alone. Hmm. You know, like I don't necessarily feel the need to change the Lord Mayor into a woman because Courtney McClellan is playing the Queen Mother and the Lord Mayor. I don't feel the need to change Knobs into a girl because Madeline Morell is playing Knobs. Mm. And it's a conceit, I think, that people buy pretty quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, once they get into the rhythm of who is this person and what are they, like, we can all sit down and say, like, well, of course, like, the knights leading an army and protecting the king were probably not women in medieval England. Like, we know that. We don't have to be reminded of that.
So, certain amount of doubling. Did you do any sort of conflating of parts? Because there are certain parts that sort of do similar jobs dramaturgically, if that makes sense.
No, we double. We double pretty extensively in all of our shows, but we don't conflate. We rewrite as little as possible.
Yeah.
We cut as little as possible. As we've kind of expanded into, say, some of the plays by Fletcher, which you know, uncut, those tend to be a bit longer and run around 3 hours or so. Then we've started cutting those texts some, because otherwise we just would not be able to stage them. Again, 90 minutes seems to be about the right length. So we like to get our plays to somewhere between like 90 minutes, 2 hours, absolute max.
Well, with this, you're struggling to get it up to 90 minutes. It's
I never struggle to make it longer. I've never ever had an audience say, you know what the problem with that play was? It was too short. And I think if you were selling, say, if you were selling the play as a full length play and then it was like 45 minutes, then you would have a problem.
Yeah.
The running time of shows in modern plays are getting shorter and shorter. And I don't think anybody has ever said that was not enough for me. I can't stand your company. I wanted a longer play. I wanted to be sitting in this uncomfortable metal chair just a little bit longer. That's never happened. Hmm. And every now and again, I will admit, like, I do have that impulse, like, oh God, we have to make the play 90 minutes. And then, you know, reason takes over and says, no, you don't. It's if it rings in at 80 minutes, it rings in at 80 minutes. Yeah. And that's awesome.
Yeah. Just want it to be good. That's the aim. That's the aim. Yes. I mean, the only, in that sense, we try to keep cutting to a minimum if we can. At the moment, one line and two words potentially have been removed. That's it. And that's they're from the Queen Mother. The two words are from the Queen Mother, because I think she tends to refer herself to herself as a weak woman or something, at some her poor woman's heart or something, and I just go, I can't have her saying that. It's just sort of this rather rubbish moment from her. That just doesn't scan very well, so I might change my mind. We'll see what happens when we're in recording.
Well, and there we have a thing where I find that when we do come across lines like that, those are lines that the women playing them will usually find a way to make meaningful in a way that we can all get behind it.
Yeah.
Like when you have, say, Baca in Cupid's Revenge, talking about what a weak and fragile woman she is. And we know that character is not. We know that that she's like the most evil character in the play, and she's running the table. Like that's a line that comes across as really powerful in the right context. And I think Courtney, in her lines as the Queen Mother, was never shy about how, like, you know, like, I am the mama bear and I will rip you apart if you do anything to my son. And, like, you make sure you take care. Like, I need you to understand I'm sending you to take care of him. And if you come back and he doesn't, you know, so so she found some very good readings of that. And I think also to kind of bridge that gap where the Queen Mother, too, is on the king's side and all this, like, you know, these peasants are just children. And I think that her presence in that way kind of reified that paternalistic authority of the king. But now I'm going down another rabbit hole. it's a problem. Like, you ask me one question and that reminds me of, like, these other cool things about the play that I really
fine.
Like.
I don't mind tangents. Tangents is what makes life interesting. Performing the play, obviously, in quite a politicized environment. You said there were quite different reactions to it before and after.
Even in the Trump campaign, like, I think they thought they were going to lose. Like, you know, one of the reasons why it took so long for them to come out and claim victory is because they didn't have a victory speech written. It was sort of the opposite when Mitt Romney lost. Like, everybody was like, why doesn't he come out and concede? And I think he said he didn't write a concession speech. And I believe him. I think they are furiously writing one now. I think that was in the Trump campaign. They did not have a victory speech prepared because all of the polling said they were going to lose. And I think we were all going into this like, they are going to lose and Hillary is going to win. And it was a really strange moment when, you know, we're now, of course, in looking at the Trump has won the election, performing these plays on that second weekend, saying that the candidate who promised us this kind of furor against immigrants and non quote unquote un-American people who are here illegally, he won. And we have since seen that his base has felt more empowered. And I think it was a couple weeks ago, there was something talking about how instances of bullying against minority populations was up in places that voted more strongly for Trump in schools. And it was kind of creepy to say that, you know, here in the 1590s, we've kind of figured out that this nativism run amok and let's burn the countryside is not necessarily a good way to live. And I'm not so sure that 2016 learned that lesson. Now, you know, and of course, it's the world did not end. And the rational part of my brain said the world is not ending. And I think, you know, you probably had something similar going on with Brexit.
I've been not saying Brexit for the last couple of minutes. Yes.
but, you know, I have several friends from the UK and I know what they were going through when that happened. And like, how can this be happening? And this is the end of the world. And the rational part of your brain is like, well, okay, the world's not ending. There's still procedures that we have to go through to make Brexit happen. There's still checks and balances on the president's power. And yet, the guy who was saying that we should be able to lock people up who haven't committed a crime and who was inciting violence at his rallies has just won. And what does that mean? And do I now need to, you know, go and buy a shotgun myself and hunker down in my hole and prepare for the hordes of the rebels who are gonna burn everything? And I think that's kind of that visceral animal response that a lot of us had. And I'm not even one of the people that is threatened directly by those policies. And I, you know, see that some of my friends who are threatened by those policies have those greater existential crises. Like, am I going to be able to walk to the subway without being attacked? Like,
well, I mean, in this side of the pond, immediately after Brexit was various friends who were going, well, am I going to be able to still work in the country? Same thing to do with racially motivated violence was a sudden upsurge, and it was that sense of suddenly an awful lot of nastiness was coming out of the woodwork, and it was deeply depressing, as it still is. I think at the moment it's more coalescing into the economic realities of which, you know, working in this field, there are literally no upsides
yeah.
to this situation for me. Economically, I can only do worse.
Well, and it's weird to think about that night now, of course, because, you know, while we've seen on our side of the Atlantic, you know, he's chipped away at these democratic norms, and he may have attacked the FBI and these other investigative bodies. He's not all powerful before them. Mm. You know, the investigation has continued. He made the whole government shutdown crisis happen because of something he saw on TV. And he basically just kind of declared defeat and walked away, you know, and of course he did lose in the midterm elections last year. And I mean, does it mean that he's not going to get reelected? No, I think he's an entertainer, and he knows how to work his base, and he knows how to work that camera. And I think he won because people felt that they had to hold their nose and pull the lever for one candidate or another, and enough people held their nose and pulled the lever for him. And we can talk about, you know, American electoral politics for days in another podcast.
Oh, we could. I think we have gone dangerously off track.
But that said, it was a scary moment.
Yeah.
It was a moment that I don't think we thought was going to happen. And some people in this cast, I you know, talked to me about, like, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. And there were some friends I had in other casts that, you know, were like, as a brown person with a certain kind of name, I am afraid. Mm. I am terrified of everything that's happening right now, and I don't know what to do. And I think that we were still on the second weekend of these performances dealing with that feeling, like, you know, we are afraid, we don't know what's going to do, like, is, you know, history has shown us exactly the guy who showed up.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit strange dealing with this idea that, you know, we have in the 1590s, this entire rebellion happened for arguably the right reasons. Mm. You know, the people were being exploited by the people who could exploit them.
Yep.
And they very quickly devolved into a mob that wanted to pillage and burn and murder.
And depictions of mobs killing, pillaging and burning things were not unknown on the London stage at the time this play was being produced. It is a theme that turns up, the power and the danger of the mob.
And I think there we have the same, we talk about, you know, how divided our country is right now all the time.
Mm.
And that's one of the reasons I think these plays speak to us, because if you think about it, like, you had Elizabeth is in her later years, she's past her childbearing age, she is not named a successor.
Mm.
You have this fear of Catholic spies everywhere. You have this fear that Spain is going to try again. The glory of the defeat of the Spanish Armada has kind of given way to an economic recession, if not a depression. It's generally bad for the common people right now. And there is the sense that the future is uncertain. You know, the queen could die at any moment, and who's going to replace her? Mm. And are we going to have another civil war, like with Bloody Queen Mary? Are the Catholics going to come back? Are the purges going to begin? So there's that I think very palpable fear that we might be having a civil war any day now. And I think in this country, you know, especially following that election, like, are we going to have another one any day now?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you try to remind yourself on the one hand that, well, probably not, because our system of government is a little bit more robust than the monarchy in the 1590s. But on the other hand, we do have a contingent of people who are preparing for and trying to incite a civil war. Mm-hmm. As we speak. So could go either way.
Now, towards the end of the play, obviously, there is the king's pardon. What did you do with that? Did you just go from the king vaguely saying, you're all free apart from you two? Or did you do something with the full Morton text?
We presented the entire pardon.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was based on my research to say, is this the actual king's pardon? And is it the text of the pardon that was stuck in there as an appendix to the play? And no, it was not. Like, this was something written for the play, and it was set aside as if it was the king's text.
Mm.
And it wasn't like information on the part of the editor, like this is part of the play. So we've got a big long speech and we're going to perform it.
How did it go?
Well, you know, I guess it would depend on the day and on the audience. I think those kind of big long speeches on stage work best when the speaker is the spotlight as opposed to being in the spotlight, and they're shining, they're giving that focus to the people they're speaking to. And then you're seeing how are these words affecting someone. And I think for long speeches in these plays, that's where the real action is. Like, it's a push and a pull with whoever they're talking to. And when they're not talking to anyone else on stage, of course, they've got that push and pull happening with the audience. So I think there we have the rebels who, you know, are being told like, oh, are we going to live or are we going to die? And it's teased out that there's this hope that you're going to walk away from this.
Yeah.
And then it kind of comes back that, you know, Tom Miller is there and Tom Miller gets to walk away and has that moment of saying, you know, final goodbyes to Jack and Watt. But also they've got to get out of here. And that kind of leads into Watt and John being resigned to their fate and saying like, you know what, knowing how this went down, I would have done it again. And so there's got to be something in that speech that hardens their resolve. And that's where I think the real subtle work of the actor comes in, because just because you don't have the lines doesn't mean you're not
doing
something. Not in that moment.
Yeah.
In a podcast, that plays out a little bit differently than on stage. But I think on stage, the really interesting thing happening is with Watt, John, and Tom. You know, and I try to stage it in such a way that they would be the focus for most of the audience, or most of the audience would be able to see them and to kind of participate in that interaction.
Well, for me, it's a matter of, you know, in the sense that there's supposed to be a group of rebels, but you know, there's a gathering. It's a matter of what matters to me is now making sure I get the sound design around that speech to match that, to try and build that sense of tension. So that's a really useful thought in terms of how I then produce that, rather than obviously there's just a long speech, which wouldn't be very exciting. Especially as it does mention people by name, you know, once you get through that sort of opening section, and it's a very aggressive, it's very aggressive language. There's a lot of meat in there.
Well, and it's also, I think, it's staged. Like there's some talk about how like the king is going to issue a pardon, and then one of his advisors, and I can't remember which, is like, instead of doing that, why don't you have them wear their halters to the gallows, and then at the gallows you deliver their pardons so they can feel that taste of death. So it's almost a stage managed political theater moment. And they talk about that, and there's something about that awareness that I enjoy, that, you know, you've got to sell this message. And does it lessen the impact of that by discussing like, okay, well, here's the idea behind my staging, and here's what I'm hoping to achieve, and then you see them do it. And at best, I can think, well, you know, this is the playwright saying that, you know, well, there was this actually happened, and someone had to have come up with the idea, and we want to make sure that it's clear that this was not the king's idea, because it seems like a cruel thing to do, and we don't want anyone thinking the king is cruel. It is to say, like, this is a staged event. All of these people are walking away. So the audience isn't in suspense. The audience knows exactly who is going to get hanged and who's going to walk away. And really, it's a matter of seeing that tension play out between those characters.
That final scene is a really nicely thought out piece of political theatre in action. And it's a contrast to so many relatively short intersecting scenes that we've had for a lot of the rest of the play. It's almost like this sort of dying fall that we have at the end. I may actually have the hanging at the very end. I'm debating what I'm doing with the sound design there. It seems like a logical way of ending the play.
Aside from let's all go home and get a good night's rest. Something like so delightfully innocent about that. Like, this crisis is past. Let's all go get some sleep.
Well, it's been a long day. You know, it's been busy.
And that's one of those things where it's like I laugh at it, and yet I also know, you know, when you do have one of those days that starts at 8 a.m. and goes until midnight, and you're doing like, we're gonna load in, we're gonna rehearse, we're gonna perform, and then I'm gonna drive out of Manhattan on a Saturday night, yeah, I do just want to go to bed. Like, drinks with everyone. Like, I'm sorry, I'm old now. I've got a long drive and I'm dying. But there's also something that's just so charmingly innocent about it, where whenever you look at plays and the king comes out on top, they've got some vision for the future. You know, we're going to go on crusade, or we're going to establish our dynasty, or we're going to invade France or something like that. And here we're left with the king's like,
I'm going to bed.
Let's go to bed. Which, I mean, again, that tells us a fun story, too. Mm. Like, what kind of king is he? Who is he? What is he?
How did the audience find it? You know, how did it go down? Always difficult to tell precisely, but...
I mean, that's another one. It's always hard to tell. I think there are some people that come to our plays under the mistaken impression that they're seeing something in a large theater and there's going to be elaborate scenery and it's going to be something that it's not. And sometimes they walk away happy and sometimes they walk away mortified that, you know, there was no walking automated trees. And it's hard to gauge sometimes. Generally speaking, I think we've started to cater to people who, as you know, our name recognition spreads, people know Bad Quarto as that alternative that does things kind of weird. We've tended to attract people who are specifically looking for this kind of experience, where we rehearse these plays in these way. Where it's a play that, you know, where else are you going to get to see it? You know, when else are you going to get to see it?
Well, to rephrase the question then, how did you think it went down in that sense?
But, I was just getting to the answer to your question now. Yes. That I've realized it. I think I was generally happy with the number of people who wanted to stick around and talk about the play afterward. And I think because we do have this intimate staging environment, it's really accessible for them to talk with the cast or with me or with someone else involved with the company after the show. And one of my great measures of success are when people want to talk about the show afterward, then we've reached them. Hmm. You know, like when you don't like the show, you want to get out of there as soon as possible.
And, yes, and the bar is empty and everybody's gone.
And talk about how bad it was to someone else.
Hmm.
But I think we are very fortunate in that, you know, in a lot of cases, we have people who want to stick around and talk about the show and learn more about it. And, you know, how come I never knew that this play existed and how come they don't teach this? And I think we had a fair number of people who stuck around for this one and who wanted to learn more about it.
I mean, one of the points of doing what I do, because I used to be and still am to some degree, a theater man. And I think we come from the same sort of area of really wanting to do repertory. In a world that doesn't really cater for it anymore. I just love to just do, you know, almost weekly rep. That would make me a very happy, happy bunny. And my thinking for this, for doing the podcast, for putting stuff online, making sure that it's there and it's accessible, is that one of the problems with a lot of these plays is that there aren't roots into. Whereas a play like Life and Death of Jack Straw, I mean, even I don't actually have a particularly decent copy of it. I found copies online. The Groundling Press has done an edition. Even with the resources that I have, actually finding material about it is there's not a vast amount.
Yeah.
Or it's not very accessible or easy to get hold of. And so it is that question of every time a production is made, trying to make sure that people can talk about it and talk more and to have this kind of a discussion. You know, we can sit here and discuss this play in relative detail because we both know it reasonably well. Well,
yeah.
There aren't many people in the world who actually can do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Even people who've read the play don't necessarily know it desperately well.
Or it's the experience that I had in grad school. Like, these are the plays that nobody talks about, and they probably talk about them for a good reason. And that kind of set me down the path of, you know, are they really bad plays, or do we think they're bad plays because nobody produces them?
Yeah.
And if we produce them, will we have a different opinion about them?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, ultimately there's always going to be some plays which are better than others. I think the problem we have is that people are always judging them as plays should be like this play. Whereas Life and Death of Jack Straw, I mean, we have been trying to discuss it in some depth. maybe more depth than actually, you know, maybe we're reading too much into what is a short, fun play which has a point, but is not going to be delved into as much as you know, a play that's three times as long. And that we shouldn't be doing that. We should just be enjoying the play for a piece of entertainment. But, you know, sometimes we should be able to actually look at these plays and say, can we just enjoy them?
But I mean, I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
No.
It's a fact that take any stringed instrument, every string is always in tune with itself.
Mm.
And if you take any one of these individual plays and look at it as an object on a stage, you can evaluate, like, is this a good time or isn't it? Mm. And quite frankly, I think if the play is not entertaining, nobody's going to want to talk about it.
Mm.
You know, like my wife and I have that experience all the time where we, well, not necessarily all the time, more than we would like. We go to see a show and we find out that the show is actually very bad. And we walk out of the theater saying, oh my God, that was terrible. And then we go to have lunch or dinner or whatever. And we talk about how bad it was. And then we forget about it because you don't want to waste brain space thinking about a bad play.
Yeah.
So if you do a good production of it, it's going to live in your mind somewhat. But that said, you know, we have many other strings on this instrument. We have the entire corpus of plays happening around it. We have all of the history happening around it. So I think we do have the option of looking at The Life and Death of Jack Straw as, you know, this is a fun play about a rebellion, and it's got some dark comedy in it. It's got some fun bits of clowning in it. It's got some good pieces of stage violence in it.
It does it does do all the things, actually, I have to say. I really am enjoying working on it. I'm hoping at the end of the day I'll do a good job on it. But then if I do a bad job, then maybe someone will listen to that and go, oh, I can do that better. Because I sometimes think that's a very important incentive. You know, why do people put on plays? It's more often than not that someone's seen a production of something and gone, oh, I can do better than that.
and you know, I've 100% had that feeling.
So what other non-canon, shall we say, plays have you done?
Let's see. Well, we've done Cupid's Revenge in 2017.
More on Cupid's Revenge. Tell us all about it. Why is it good?
Cupid's Revenge is good because it has the setup of a romantic comedy, and then the bodies start hitting the floor. like you get this delightful moment early on where they say that we need to abolish the worship of Cupid because it's causing the people to do all of these morally bad things. So it's very much an anti-Puritan play.
Mm.
And they abolish the worship of Cupid. And Cupid's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to get revenge on them. And it's kind of set up like he's going to make people fall in love with the wrong people the way that Cupid would do. But he does it to murder them. Mm. And it very quickly turns into a fest of bodies hitting the stage. One of the clown characters gets killed really early on, like very quickly. It punches you in the mouth and then just keeps doing it. I found the play itself, the more I looked at it, just very unapologetically misogynistic, but also everybody doing everything is working under the influence of Cupid. I think it's easier for me to say that we had a that show went well because I didn't direct that one for the company.
Mm.
That was directed by Angelina Labar. And so it was easier for me to be just a little bit outside of it and to be, you know, looking at people's reactions to it and to look at it a little bit more objectively. And I think it went very well.
Mm.
I think it's partly, you know, the further away you get from the 1590s, the closer things become to what we expect from modern theater. You know, everything takes place in one or two locations. It's instead of massive armies on stage talking to one another, you have one or two people and then they exit, because at that point, you know, the private playhouses were where it was at. So they were writing for a smaller stage. They were writing for a smaller cast. I was happy with the way that went. I think it did the thing it needs to do, where it starts off feeling like a romantic comedy, and then it kicks you in the stomach and it keeps kicking you.
Mm.
And it ends in a tragedy, and one bad thing piles on top of another so quickly that you're just like, even by the end of it, after I think we cut it down to about 100 minutes or so. So after 80 minutes of saying like, oh my God, where did this, all this death come from? You're still saying like, how did this fall out like this? I thought this was going to be a romantic comedy. Like, and there was no redemption. It just was all, it all ended badly.
Sounds like my kind of play.
Because, I mean, that's one of the fun things about it. Usually when you look at a revenge play, the revenger has to die, you know, because this person stepped outside of the rule of law to enact their just revenge, and they can't be reintegrated into society. But the guy getting revenge is a god.
Yeah.
So he doesn't get any comeuppance. He more or less gets to do what he wants. And Cupid says early on, I am going to destroy this royal house in revenge for them desecrating my temple. And he does.
Cupid, on the whole, in most plays from the period, does turn out to be quite a beautifully wrong character in so many ways.
He's not a guy you want to hang out with.
No, no. Right. Anything more on Jack Straw or anything else you want to say while I've got you?
I think it's a fun play. I think I would like to see it done more. I would like to see more of these plays done more. And I encourage everyone to read them and look for ways to stage them. And thank you for doing that.
Well, I was going to say you have a website or something, a webpage on your Jack Straw, as I recall.
Yeah.
Or is there anything else to plug about you? Just where can we find you on the interweb?
Well, you can find me personally at tonytambasco.com, and that's got links to my relevant social media. And if you want to learn more about Bad Quarto Productions, that is at badquarto.org.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for talking to me this morning, afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Many thanks to Tony Tambesco for sharing his time and material on the life and death of Jack Straw. Links to the materials mentioned are in the show description. You've been listening to the Beyond podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Beyond Shakes, support us online on Patreon at patreon.com/BeyondShakespeare, or you can buy us a coffee on ko-fi.com/BeyondShakespeare, and all that jazz. Till next time, I've been your host, Robert Crichton. Goodbye.